Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this term is Nygaard versus Sioux Valley Hospitals Health System. For the appellant, Nygaard is Mr. Eric Magnuson, and for the appellee, Sioux Valley Health Systems, is Mr. Roberto Lang. Mr. Magnuson is from Minneapolis, Mr. Lang from Sioux Falls. I should point out that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Randall Macy, a judge of the Fourth Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabers' place. Mr. Magnuson, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. Counsel, it's a pleasure to be before you again. Rule 12 dismissals are appropriately disfavored in the law. They shut the doors to the courthouse to litigants before they can take a second step. And because they are disfavored, this court applies de novo review. You accept all of the allegations of the complaint as true. You draw every inference from those facts in favor of the plaintiff. And you still have to say, as a matter of law, that there is, beyond any doubt, no way the plaintiff can prove a claim. With all due respect to the trial judge in this case, he didn't apply that test. He didn't like the claims, and he decided them on the merits and not on the pleadings. I'd like to start by talking about what our claims are here. I think that they've been confused by my opponents. They're really quite simple. Our clients and thousands of other people in their situation were charged excessive and unreasonable fees by the hospitals where they were treated. With devastating consequences for some, they were charged these excessive fees by institutions that portrayed themselves as charitable, cost-effective, compassionate, caring. They'd take into account your financial circumstances in setting the fees. That was what they portrayed themselves as. But when you show up at the hospital, you're given a form to sign, and it says you'll pay whatever the hospital charges you. And the hospitals take advantage of that contract to insert a price term that our allegation is, which you must accept as true, is excessive and unreasonable. Two or three times.
Mr. Magnuson, you're attempting a statewide class action, correct?
Yes.
Is there any, it doesn't exist in Minnehaha County because you have more than one hospital, as we're about to find out in second argument, but most counties probably only have one hospital in that county. Does that affect your cause of action, help it, hurt it, or doesn't affect it at all?
I don't think it helps it in any way. We're not arguing public policy or judicial regulation of the hospitals. What we're saying is you have to charge either the exact price that you put in a contract, which they don't have, or, and we've only got cases against these two hospitals now, or you have to charge a reasonable amount if you don't have a price stated. And so it's a simple contract claim. It's a contract claim for every patient.
Mr. Magnuson, what about the other claims in the complaint? In your brief, you clarify that you're only seeking breach of contract.
And as
you just stated, for excessive and unreasonable fees. But there's a lot of language in this complaint. It's kind of what I might call left over from the federal litigation that does not appear to have succeeded anyplace.
Right.
Are you telling us essentially then that you're limiting your claim to the breach of contract, the adhesion, and that type of thing?
Your Honor, we have two legal claims, breach of contract and violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Okay? There are legal theories pleaded in the complaint that relate to, for example, the breach of contract claim. The covenant of good faith and fair dealing informs the breach of contract question. Okay? The adhesion contract argument informs the breach of contract question. Unjust enrichment and constructive trust are remedies if we prevail on the claim.
I understand that.
There is language in the complaint to which you refer that talks about 501c3 status and charitable institutions. And it may not be as clear as we would have liked, but I will state unequivocally, as we did to the circuit court in our briefing there, we're not suing these companies because they're not acting as 501c3 corporations. What we're saying is they portray themselves as charitable institutions that take into consideration your financial ability to pay. They bring you into the hospital, give you a form contract that you are under no ability to negotiate whatsoever, make you sign it, and then they choose the price to put in, and they choose an unreasonable and excessive price.
If they had had a stated price in the contract, would that have solved the problem, no matter what the price was?
If they had a stated price, we would not have a breach of an express contract claim. We would still have the adhesion contract issue and perhaps the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, but that would be more difficult. But they don't have a stated price.
What does the contract say about pricing?
It says that you will pay the charges we bill you for. That's the allegation in the complaint. We don't have the contract as part of the record.
If the hospital was able to show that they charged your client or clients the standard fee in the industry, would that mean you didn't have a case?
Your Honor, there would still be a question of fact whether the standard fee in the industry is reasonable. That would be evidence of its reasonableness. You know, we suspect, and we've alleged in the complaint, that if we get into discovery here, what we're going to see is that the things they charge the uninsured patients bear no relationship at all to their actual cost of providing the service. You know, we can compare it to Medicare or insured patients, but we're not making the claim, as the circuit court thought we were. And, you know, appeals are nice because they clarify things. It is not the claim that we have a right to be charged exactly the same as an insured patient. What we have is a contract that's silent on how much we're going to be charged. We have a healthcare provider that puts in a price that is two or three times what they charge anybody else. We have the allegation that that's unreasonable and oppressive, which you have to take as true in analyzing this case. That's
Is the contract unlawful merely because it's silent as to price?
Is the contract unlawful?
Merely because it's silent as to price.
No, Your Honor. The law, when parties have agreed to a contract and they leave something like the price silent, the law implies a reasonable term. Or if the contract is invalid, but the services are provided, the hospital gets quantum merit, but that is still a reasonable amount. So our claim is not that the contract fails. Our claim is that under contract law principles, you know, the Servideo case and the Turner case from Oregon and Illinois address this expressly. Section 204 of the restatement addresses this expressly. When you don't have a price term, the law implies a reasonable term. Now, the covenant of good faith and fair dealing does the same thing. That is a doctrine that says if you've got a contract and one party has the technical ability under the contract to do something that denies the other party the bargain for benefit, it's not a breach of the contract because the contract says they can put in whatever price they want. The law still prohibits them from acting in a way that takes the benefit of the bargain away from our clients. Now, what was the bargain? Our clients asked for and received medical services and agreed to pay for them. They implicitly agreed to pay a reasonable price. You can't say that the contract was they agreed to pay an unreasonable price. The law doesn't say that. Okay, and our argument is even though technically it is not a breach of the contract for the hospital to put a charge in there, what they have an obligation of good faith and fair dealing to put a reasonable charge in there, not an unreasonable charge, because we are deprived of the benefit of our bargain.
Well, now your client, Mrs. Nygaard, as I understand the allegations, she's saying that she never did pay the full price that she was charged.
She tried to pay it, Your Honor. The allegation.
But I mean, she didn't pay the full price, right? I mean, she paid
what she could.
She paid what she could. And we don't know in the record what that is at this point, or at least it's
right.
not alleged.
So
what are her damages?
Well, her damages are to the extent that she has paid more than a reasonable price. Her damages are the difference. Okay. She also has.
We don't know if she's paid half of it, or a third of it, or a tenth of it. But whatever that is, you're saying that it's she paid more than she should have paid.
Well, I think that's an inference you can draw. I mean, we're at pleading stage now.
Right.
You're asking me factual questions.
Right,
be happy to address the factual questions. I mean, first of all, you've got to figure out what the reasonable cost of the services is. And if she gets billed $20,000 for something where we can show after fact discovery that the reasonable cost is $5,000 and she pays $7,000, she's got a claim.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out what her damages are, because if she's got a successful result from the hospital, successful surgery, and that's okay. In other words, what the services they gave her were okay, satisfactory. And she's not paid the full price that the hospital charged her, even though she's contending that the full price was excessive.
Right.
Where are her damages? Is she
her damage? I'm sorry, I should have let you finish.
Are her damages solely because she's contending that she paid more than she should have, or are there some other damages the hospital should be paying her for some injury that you're contending that she suffered, some financial injury?
I think that is a fair inference from the complaint as well.
She would get the difference between what the hospital should have charged her and what she paid, whatever amount that is.
Right.
Plus she would get an additional amount of damages from the hospital to compensate her for what?
Well, in Mr. Dosh's case, he was forced into bankruptcy. Now, you know, that's a stretch, but it is a legal claim, whether we have the facts to support it. She also was charged fees and late penalties and things like that, to the extent that she's paid any of those. But she is also entitled to have the court say, you're free of the obligation to pay further unreasonable charges. Otherwise, she is still deprived of the benefit of her bargain. You know, a breach of contract is remedied by placing the parties in the position they would have enjoyed but for the breach. Now, that can take the form of monetary damages. It can also take the form of a statement by the court, you don't have to pay any of these unreasonable charges. I think that's a clear breach of contract claim. Let me turn to the...
Let me ask you one more question on damages. On the breach of the statutory violation here,
yes.
Are there damages that she could collect on that too?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that they may be similar to, if not coextensive, with the breach of contract. She might be, I don't recall if the statute grants her a right to attorney's fees. Okay, it is an alternative legal theory, but you don't get tossed out on Rule 12 because you've got alternative or overlapping legal theories.
Thank you.
Okay, now the Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim is born out of the same set of facts. Here you have a hospital that holds itself out to the world as a charitable organization, one that provides cost-effective care, one that treats patients and then bills them with their financial ability to pay in mind. That's how they represent themselves to the world. The allegation in the complaint is that's false, because the truth is that they charge uninsured patients two or three or more times what they charge anybody else. How many patients do you think they'd get if their website said, if you come here and don't have insurance, we're going to charge you three times what we charge anybody else? Now, our allegation is that would be a true statement. And they hide it. They mislead the public. They misled the plaintiff in this case, and that states a claim under the Deceptive Trade Practices.
Are you saying they have to post all their prices then? Is that?
Nope. They can choose to have a contract exactly as they have. They don't have to post any price. But the law will then provide a price for them. It will be a reasonable price. And if they want to collect more than a reasonable price, I mean, that's the doctrine we talked about, the restatement, the cases that say if the parties agree to essentially a contract and get it done, and the fact that they've got a term that they haven't reached an express agreement on, the law implies a reasonable
term. Well, but you say the law. Well, that's not a human being. I mean, is the judge going to set the reasonable price then, or who sets
it? Fact finder. fact finder decides what the reasonable cost is. I mean, you're going to have...
So every time you get a claim like this, you go to court?
If they charge unreasonable prices, yes.
But how are you? If you're the hospital, how are you going to know if your price is reasonable or not until you've had a jury tell you time after time after time in each case it is or it isn't?
I think that we'll be able to get into the facts to show, once we get to discovery, how they set prices. I mean, this is not unsophisticated. You know, you're going to have consultants that come in and say, you know, here is the cost to the hospital, here's a reasonable amount of overhead, so this is a reasonable price and you can compare it to others. Okay, and then, you know, the plaintiffs are going to come in and say, you know, that's an inflated cost of service, they get a better discount. You're going to get that resolve. But the fact that it may be factually intensive, Your Honor, doesn't mean you throw us out of court on Rule 12. That's the whole point. If we're again talking about the facts of the case, and we don't talk about the facts at this point. We talk about the legal claims.
Where did the trial court go wrong here?
The trial court didn't like this case from the beginning. And what he said was, you know, you're saying that they have to charge uninsured and insured patients the same, and that's baloney. Now, that wasn't our claim. What we said is the uninsured patients are charged this, I'm not tall enough, and the insured patients are charged this, okay? And that is evidence that this is unreasonable, okay? Now, the trial court was, or no trial, the circuit court was inundated with the same volume of cases that you've been given about this litigation nationally. And my opponent did a very good job of convincing the court that we were the same as those cases, and courts have tossed those out left and right. Okay, we don't claim to be the same as those cases. This is there. Although we talk about the Internal Revenue Code, for example, it is the context for the representations that they make. All right. But what he said is, your claim is baloney because you can't. The law will not impose the requirement that charges be uniform. Well, that wasn't our claim. But if you start there, and he said, and since that claim is baloney, they didn't do anything to mislead anybody, and therefore the statute of limitations isn't told because they didn't do anything wrong. That's kind of circular, all right? And he never addressed the bankruptcy argument for Mr. Dosh, but I'll save that for the next. So what he did was he accepted a characterization of the claim that wasn't accurate, and then decided that, you know, it was legally unsustainable.
You know, sometimes the case we hear is not the same case that the trial court heard. Did you present the same characterization of your claim?
Yes.
To Judge Keene that you're,
yes,
that
Your
you're
Honor.
Clarifying today?
Yes, I made a point of going back and pulling the briefs that we submitted and reviewing them, and they are consistent with the claims we're making today. Okay. you've been given a ton of cases from around the country, state and federal cases. And some of them are helpful and some of them aren't. To ground yourself in this, I might suggest that you read four cases. They've cited the Kalari case and the Borner case. I didn't get that right. I'll get it on rebuttal when I come up. But it was in that submission that they came up with. I think it's Borner, B-O-E-R-N-E-R. And those are pretty thoughtful cases that say, you know, under the particular allegations of the particular complaints in those states, and under the law of those states, no claim. All right? The problem with any of these foreign cases is you've got to actually know what the complaint said, which you can't tell from the opinion. And you've got to actually know what the particular law of that state says. Deceptive Trade Practices Acts vary from state to state. Some cases or some statutes require reliance. The South Dakota statute doesn't. So if you've got a failure to state a claim decision from Montana and it says the complaint doesn't allege reliance, it doesn't do you much good because that's not an element under South Dakota law. But the Kalari and the Borner case, I think, are pretty good cases for them. The Cervedio and the Turner case, for us, are pretty good cases. They go right down the line.
What was the last one? Cervedio and what?
Turner.
Turner, thank
They're
you.
They're both in the appendix to our brief. Okay. You'll hear my argument echoed through those cases. In both cases, the court said, we're not here to decide the facts. We're here to decide if this complaint states a legal claim. And it does. Now, whether you win or not doesn't matter. That's not what we're deciding today. You state a claim. Okay. Our claim is that they overcharged our clients by inserting unreasonable and oppressive fees into their contract. If that doesn't state a claim, what you're telling the uninsured citizens of South Dakota is you can be overcharged by a hospital and there's nothing you can do about it because you went in when you were sick and you signed a piece of paper and it's too bad, they get to charge you whatever they want. I don't believe that's the law. I don't believe it should be the law. And I think we've stated a claim under both breach of contract and under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Lang, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, the circuit court properly dismissed Nygaard's complaint for failure to state a claim. Nygaard's complaint and arguments seek to create new law preventing hospitals like Sioux Valley from charging their standard rates for hospital services to uninsured patients. Nygaard's arguments are better addressed to the state legislature or to Congress than to the court system or to juries.
Isn't this the problem that we don't know whether they're the standard rates? Isn't that the argument? That it needs to get beyond this 12B motion in order to find out whether that's a standard rate?
I don't believe so, Justice Meyer-Henry. The allegations of the complaint, which this court must look at in judging whether there's a claim stated, starts with paragraph 50 alleging what the contract is. And the plaintiff, Nygaard, has alleged that there was an express form contract by which she agreed to pay undiscounted charges for medical care, which was set by the hospital. And those are the standard rates that the hospital uses, the undiscounted charges for care.
If a patient feels they've been overcharged, how do they contest that?
Well, Your Honor, the standard rates are available in the business office of the hospital. The hospital or the patient certainly has an opportunity to discuss with the hospital, request a discount, request indeed charity care. I believe it's...
What if they don't agree?
What if the hospital does not agree? Then there may be a collection action, and during the collection action, there is an opportunity for a counterclaim.
So the hospital can bring a claim to collect the bill, but the patient can't bring a claim to challenge the amount of the bill.
No, I don't believe the patient does have the right to bring a claim like this under these circumstances to challenge the amount of the bill. What in essence the plaintiff is advocating is a sea change in the current law that has existed for many years. This court has decided several cases, including the Wookie case, the Litchfield case, and the Nealon case, where this court has found patients and indeed family members of patients to be responsible for the standard rates that hospitals charge.
The amount of the rate in those, was that contested in those cases or just responsibility for the rate?
I believe those cases centered primarily on responsibility for the rate, Chief Justice Gilbertson. There was no claim made in those cases, nor did the court comment on the reasonableness of the rate. However, the court required the standard rate to be paid in those cases. It's important for the court on this motion to dismiss to start with the allegations of this complaint, which contend on the breach of contract claim that an express contract was entered into by which she agreed to pay the undiscounted charges for the medical bills. That's what the plaintiff, Nygaard, claims is the contract. Nygaard then claims that Sioux Valley billed the full undiscounted charges, the standard rates, to her. In other words, Sioux Valley did what the contract permitted it to do. The contention then in paragraph 52 of the complaint for what constitutes a breach of contract is that Sioux Valley breached its contractual obligations by charging the full undiscounted cost for medical care. Well, that is exactly the conduct that the plaintiff says the contract contemplated. That is conduct that is permitted by the contract. Indeed, that's what the contract allows.
But Mr. Lane, you know, I almost feel, when I read the briefs, like you two were two ships passing in the night. You point that out, and there's no question the complaint says that. But also, the complaint says we were just charged an unreasonable fee, and there's got to be a cause of action for a patient who claims they were charged an unreasonable fee. And it, wouldn't at least those portions of this complaint that simply allege I got charged under an unreasonable fee for my medical procedure, doesn't that state a claim, that very simple proposition?
Alone, I do not believe it does. We operate today in a free market system where businesses are free to decide what they charge for their services. Attorneys, for example, are free to choose to charge discounted rates to those who purchase in bulk or do pro bono service when they choose.
But there's no one says that attorneys can't be sued for charging an unreasonable fee. Happens all the time.
Well, Your Honor, of course that's not the case we're dealing with, but it's the analogy I chose, so I'm stuck with the question. I think it's a different situation altogether here. The contract, let me start with what the allegation is. The contract claim, as Justice Zinter pointed out, reads as I stated, and that does not state a claim for a breach of contract. So now we have the plaintiffs claiming that there's some unreasonableness, and they make up statements like 2 to 3 times what others get charged, some unreasonableness that entitles them to a claim. There is no authority that I am familiar with in the state of South Dakota that allows someone to sue simply because they deem something unreasonable.
Let me interrupt you there, because the one distinguishing factor I see here is that there's no price stated in the contract. If there had been a price stated in the contract, I think the point you just made would be well taken. But what do you do about the case where there is no price stated in the contract? Don't you then have a right to litigate whether the price that was charged after the fact was reasonable?
I believe that's true under the Uniform Commercial Code that deals with transactions and goods. And of course, hospital services are not transactions and goods. There are, in some of these cases, pointed out the fact that it is impossible for a hospital to be expected to provide a patient who comes in, especially for emergency room care, with a list of all of the multitude, literally thousands, of procedures and drugs and services that the hospital provides. Indeed, hospitals provide individualized care depending on the patient and the patient's needs. So as a practical matter, and certainly the legislature and the court system has never required that a hospital list out or provide a patient a large stack of information on what the standard rates are, that's available in the business office, and it would defeat somewhat the notion of emergency care. Indeed, some people come in unconscious to a hospital.
Although I noticed that some of the cases in other states have what they call charter rates, or they have listed rates that are incorporated and available and publicly disclosed in the contract documents.
To my understanding, South Dakota does not. Although the South Dakota legislature has recently, as the court knows, begun to address that by requiring hospitals to post through the Department of Health information on the 25 most common procedures in Sioux Valley, as the court knows, has already voluntarily complied with that and done more. So while we don't have that system in place, Justice Zinter, the legislature has established a system, is addressing this, and it truly is a question that isn't for a jury in each occasion. Every time there's a hospital bill to decide what's reasonable and what's not, in their opinion, there's bound to be conflicts in what a jury might decide as in terms of what it believes is reasonable and what is not, and the notion of fact discovery and expert testimony on all of the various occasions where a hospital sends out a bill is an unwieldy way of dealing with the plaintiff's concerns. Rather, this is a situation that is more properly addressed to legislative bodies rather than to judges and juries. And along those lines, skipping forward a bit in the argument, the scorecard as it exists right now on how these cases are doing is not very good for the plaintiffs. As the court knows, the initial approach of the plaintiff's attorneys were to file federal actions and then try to have them consolidated before the judicial panel on multi-district litigation. The plaintiffs lost on that. Then federal district courts began ruling on motions to dismiss, and by my count, the plaintiffs lost 28-0 at least on those, with the Bobo case and the Kalari cases being federal district court decisions that actually reached the merits and the claims, the state law claims, and dismissed those as well. Now, the plaintiff's approach, followed by Nygaard, who, by the way, filed in federal court initially before the JPM MDL decision, and then voluntarily dismissed out of federal court as these decisions were coming down. In state court now, Plaintiff Nygaard would have you read Servideo and Turner. Servideo, which is an Illinois Cook County case, is, to my knowledge, the only case where a court has written a reasoned opinion that actually finds for the plaintiffs on a motion to dismiss. Turner seemed to be a decision where some claims were dismissed and some claims weren't, and there wasn't a reasoned opinion. Servideo is from the Cook County Circuit Court. So is the Galvin case, which dismissed all of the claims that the plaintiffs were making in a identical case to what Servideo brought. The Galvin case from the Cook County Circuit Court is actually later than Servideo. Servideo was decided January 20, 2005. Galvin from the same court decided November 7, 2005, decides for the hospitals. There's another case from Illinois called Schmidt, decided in February of 2005, that sides with the hospitals. So the only reasoned opinion that the plaintiffs can present, that I have seen, that rules in favor of the plaintiffs on a motion to dismiss is one that has not been followed locally by the court and not been followed by another court within Illinois. The states of Louisiana, New Hampshire, Arizona, Georgia, Ohio, and South Dakota at the circuit court level have granted motions to dismiss in entirety on claims of this nature, following with Kalari and Bobo.
I'm curious why you so actively pursued this as a 12B5 disposition. I can't remember what it was I read in the record, but it seemed to me that counsel went out of their way to make sure that the trial court didn't look at anything outside the pleadings. And I'm just curious why you didn't let this get maybe to summary judgment before resolving it, because, I mean, we have to assume whatever's pled is true and at least give them a chance to try to prove it. And it's problematic to me to dispose of an unreasonable claim case on a 12B5 motion.
Well, my answer is because it was ripe for dismissal under Rule 12B5, and I believe this court should affirm because of that. Each of the claims, as you work your way through it, and now this case has been simplified on appeal to two claims, basically breach of contract and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Each of the claims, as you look at them, as pled, don't hold up. As mentioned earlier, they allege that the contract was that the hospital was to charge the full undiscounted price. The hospital did so. And then the allegation is that that's the breach of contract, that the hospital charged the full undiscounted price. That doesn't state a contract claim as a matter of law. Looking very briefly at the Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim, that claim contends, in essence, that Sioux Valley is violating the statute by holding itself out as a charitable entity under 501c3 and some of the same language that was used in the federal cases alleging that there's some action under 501c3 appears right in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim. In this situation, the plaintiff lacks standing to make the claims because she received the hospital care, had no complaint as to the quality, wasn't covered by a governmental plan, and was able to make substantial payments, so not qualified for charity care. Moreover, looking at the statute provisions, there are two provisions of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act that inform us as to what conduct truly is sought to be outlawed by that statute. 3724.6.2 permits the advertisement of merchandise, which includes services, at its regular price. Well, if the advertisement of services at its regular price is expressly permitted by the statute, certainly charging for services at the regular price would be permitted by the statute as well.
But how do we know if this is the regular price? I mean, isn't that the issue here?
I don't believe it is, because in Section 50 of the complaint, it is alleged that Sioux Valley charged its undiscounted price for medical care, its full regular price. So it is, on the complaint, accepted that that is what Sioux Valley did.
But what about paragraph 10? Paragraph 10 says that they breached their contract, and they list five or six ways. And a lot of them are probably tenuous under the cases around the country. But one of them is they breached their contract by failing to charge its uninsured patients a reasonable cost for medical care. End of phrase. Now, that claim, it seems to me, has got to be actionable. I mean, that states a claim, does it not? That simple phrase, that a patient was charged an unreasonable cost for medical care in a case where the price is not disclosed in the contract.
I don't believe it does, and I direct the court to Section 52, which is actually within the breach of contract allegations, where the alleged breach is by charging the full undiscounted costs for medical care.
Do Sioux Valley's charges have to be reasonable?
I think for Sioux Valley to arrive as an entity in the competitive climate it has with Avera, it does have to have, as a matter of competitiveness, reasonable charges. I don't believe there is any law that obliges or requires Sioux Valley or any business in a free market society to charge reasonable prices, whatever that phrase means.
Mr. Magnuson characterized it as they can charge whatever price they want. Do you agree with that?
I think within reason, well, the answer is it's a free market system and any business can charge any price it wants. It's a question of whether a business then prices itself out of the market. And there's no accusation that Sioux Valley is monopolistic. It is a fierce competitor of Avera McKinnon.
Back to your argument on paragraph 52. If you look right ahead of that, in paragraph 51, they allege a contractual obligation to charge no more than a fair and reasonable charge, period. Doesn't that state a claim? Paragraph 51.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The allegations here are obviously all over the place bit here.
That's the problem. And that's why I said this is like two ships passing in the night. Even in your briefs, you know, you focus on, you know, the undiscounted price. They focus on a reasonable price. And it doesn't seem to me like either of you have come to a meeting of the minds about what this case is really about.
Well, what this case is really about is the plaintiffs trying to change healthcare policy through the court system. And if you read the complaint in full, although they back away from it now, their notion of what a reasonable price is tied to discounts that are granted to Medicare, Medicaid patients, or to those who are insured. After all, they're representing a class that carves out everyone who is insured, or they purport to represent such a class, that carves out everyone who is insured or subject to Medicare or Medicaid. Their notion of reasonableness is tied to the discounts that are given, properly given, required under Medicare, Medicaid, and properly given for those that have the ability to negotiate discounts, such as health insurance providers. And indeed, individuals have the ability to go to Sioux Valley and seek a discount, or charity care as well. For the reasons that I've already expressed, Your Honors, we ask that the court affirm Judge Keene's well-reasoned decision granting dismissal of all of the plaintiff's claims.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Magnuson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. There is no meetings of the minds between the plaintiffs and the defendants in this case, and I would hope that there not be. Because if I have to meet their mind, I have to agree that uninsured patients in South Dakota have no recourse when they're overcharged for medical bills. And I submit that can't be the law. We're not asking for a sea change in the law. We're asking that we be allowed to pursue a breach of contract claim. When asked whether the charges have to be reasonable, counsel paused for a long time because that's a tough argument for him to concede. But if he concedes, as he ultimately did, that the charges the hospital submits to uninsured patients have to be reasonable, and if you read paragraph, I was going to take them to 50, 51, and 52 of the complaint. The allegation there is 50, on admission plaintiff in the class entered into express form contracts with defendant whereby plaintiff in the class were required to agree to pay unspecified and undiscounted charges for medical care, which charges were set by defendant in its sole discretion. Imputed in these contracts is the express or implied contractual obligation by defendant that it would charge plaintiff in the class no more than the fair and reasonable charge for such medical care. Paragraph 51, similar allegation. Paragraph 52, defendant breached its contractual obligations under these express form contracts and implied contracts by charging plaintiff and the class the highest and full undiscounted rate for medical care. These charges are unfair and unreasonable, and they bear no relation to the actual cost of providing such services. It states a claim. The contract is silent on the amount. The law implies a reasonable amount. It's a fact question what's reasonable. Even if they have the right under the contract, the technical right to set any amount they want, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing says a party to a contract can't use its rights under the contract to deny the benefit of the bargain to the other side. Even if there's no breach of the express terms of the contract, Garrett says, it's still a breach of the implied covenant if you do that. The bargain we thought we had was medical care at a reasonable price because no other price was stated. It states a claim. And if you don't imply, if you say, no, we're not going to impute into anything, they get to charge what they get to charge, then it's a contract of adhesion, and that term is invalid. And then you're still left with a fact question on reasonableness.
Let me stop you on that point.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I read your brief and understand the statement that you just made, you're essentially agreeing that the adhesion claim is part of the breach of contract.
It is.
And that the adhesion claim is essentially defensive in nature in that it only prevents the enforcement of unconscionable terms. It's not a sword by which there's some cause of action for damages necessarily.
Right, for bad faith.
Okay.
What it does is it prevents them from enforcing the term of the contract that says they get to set the price. If that term is enforceable, we can never win because we signed an agreement that says they're going to set the price. Now, Our claim is, implicit in that was the understanding on both sides it would be reasonable. It wasn't, therefore they breached the contract. But if you say, no, we're not going there, you signed a contract, it's a deal, then defensive use of the contract of adhesion gets us into an offensive breach of contract claim. And the deceptive trade practices claim is similarly based in the context of this case. They portray themselves as charitable. They say they're going to take financial condition into account. They lure people in, and if they told the truth, they would advertise, come on down, if you don't have insurance, don't worry about it, we'll only charge you 3 times what we charge everybody else. How many patients would they get? None. We are not making up statements, although under Rule 12, counsel said that they just make up these statements of fact. Well, we get to do that. That's what Rule 12 tests, whether we've made up the right statements of fact. We have. We're confident when we get to trial, we'll have facts to back that up. I can leave the remaining 5 minutes on the clock.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early in this court.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And since we run on the hour because of internet coverage, we will commence the next argument at 10 o'clock.
Thank you.
Thank you.